Hello, and welcome to Peter's Podcast, where we talk about real yoga, actual happiness, and deep living. Thanks for joining me. New York, 2003. My life has been about not for so long. Not what my father wanted, not India, not selling out to a tech corporation. You have given it something to be for, Krishna said. Well, why can't that continue? Ryoko said, as she pulled the sheet up and shivered. Because we're on the cover of every stupid tabloid, he replied, as he spun out from the covers and put his feet on the cool wood floor. He picked up a paper from the bedside table with a paparazzi photo of him and Ryoko below the headline, Veritage's new sitcom, and threw it across the room. To hell with the tabloids, Krishna, Ryoko said, and ran her fingers down his back. They're the worst kind of journalism. They're fucking accurate, though, aren't they? He asked at the floor. Make love to me. He ran his hand rapidly over his hair and turned toward her. Ryoko, when I left India, I had my hand held out like a stop sign. I hung out around the world of TV, which I love, but instead of getting involved, I invented a way to sit on the sidelines and comment about it. But that idea has turned TV into a medium for truth. That's your doing. You were the one who described my simple idea as veritas, reporting the truth. Your mission is to change the world, darling. Until I met you, my mission was nothing. Now it's you. It's more than me, surely, love, Ryoko encouraged. Exactly. It's you and your mission, Veritas. That's why I have to get us out of the press's eye and get the focus back on how Veritas is changing the world. But Krishna, really, I could get some PR people to make this all go away, spin it as a misrepresentation of the situation. That's just it, Ryoko. That would be a lie. Look, if we had a Veritas comment stream on this, the facts would be that we're having an affair, that your husband Joey is graciously looking the other way, and that the Integrity Network is suffering because of it. Well, what do you want to do? What do I want to do? I want to lie here making love to you with one hand while we're changing the world with the other. But you don't think we can do that? She half asked, snuggling up to him like a soldier's wife the day he's leaving for duty. I think I may regret my next words until the end of my days, he said, spinning the rest of the way to face her, sitting on his heels on the bed. But I think the reason we came together is to create Veritas. We're like parents. Our relationship has to be about looking out for our offspring. Ryoko began to cry. Krishna had not held a crying woman since his mother was dying. At Ryoko's tears, he felt a kind of death in himself. It was like a void that birthed something new. The new thing was melancholy. That melancholy poured into the newborn gulf between them that he pledged to himself not to cross. Albany, another 2001. Krishna had been staying at Ryoko's Albany apartment most nights since their evening of mock TV commenting. As she had constant access to and interest in him, her report on the state of TV emphasized his software. The story had just aired with praise from her editor and good ratings. Ryoko had not started on a new story yet and took advantage of the lull to meet Krishna at the apartment for lunch. Lunch turned into lovemaking that kept her from returning until late afternoon. She found several messages from the secretary of the Association of Television Broadcasters director, John Martin, on her desk. She called the number, which had a Washington, D.C. area code. The ATB director surprised her by saying that the networks wanted to talk about Krishna's system. In a follow-up call with Krishna on the line, he said ATB wanted to form a work group to implement the system proactively, but they also wanted to provide some level of quality control to avoid the liability and embarrassment that uncensored comments could produce. The day before the scheduled meeting, John Martin told Ryoko and Krishna that film auteur Joseph Jones would be joining the workgroup. They both knew of him. He was an emerging presence in contemporary cinema. As they rode the train down to their first workgroup meeting at ATB headquarters in Washington, Krishna and Ryoko discussed his TV mockumentary series that addressed vice in America. Ryoko liked the series, but said his first film, The Man Who Could Talk to Dogs, was hard to beat. Krishna raved about his new film noir tribute, Better to Have Loved and Lost, which starred Jones's girlfriend, the singer and now actress Blanche DuBois. Once the introductions were made, Martin, Kimura, Anand, Jones, ATB's public relations head, Marianne Fox, a designer, and an ATB copywriter tipped their toes into the murky waters of censorship and free press, payment, and independence. Director Martin set the stage. Miss Kimura, may I call you Ryoko? Your story on the software Mr. Anand has developed got us to thinking that TV can always use new ideas, and perhaps the best way to incorporate this one is to get on board and figure out how to make it great. Great meaning lucrative, Ryoko inserted. Well, of course, that's part of my agenda, but in broadcasting, we find that it's very hard to predict what will be lucrative. That's why you produce the same things over and over, Jones interjected, firing off a line that he often used to criticize the film industry. Like reality TV, Ryoko said, remembering her first commenting session with Krishna. Women with big breasts, Krishna added, reminiscing about the same episode. Martin was smooth. That criticism is completely valid, but when production costs are so high and advertisers are so dependent on viewership, we're forced to hedge our bets until something that we sense is great comes to shake things up. Krishna dropped what little guard he had up. Well, my idea sprung from a neutral place, really. I thought TV could benefit from the same interactivity that the web has been enjoying. I wasn't thinking of it helping or hurting the TV business. The writer piped up. I was doing some preliminary brainstorming and came up with the idea that commenting to other people while you're watching TV is like the original theater environment in Shakespeare's day, which is more dynamic, so we could play that up. Yeah, Joseph responded, working in theater is satisfying. You feel the audience. You seem to want to control the way the software is used, Ryoko added, but Krishna has said that the way people participate will shape TV commenting, just as it did on the internet. Martin pushed the conversation like steering a canoe through rough water. So what I'm hearing is that there's a benefit to feeling the audience interaction, and things should progress organically. Any other thoughts, Ryoko? Or any questions that could tease us out more? What are you proposing exactly, is my question, Ryoko cut to the chase. Martin put his cards on the table, though they were few. I'm looking for a group solution to take care of implementing this system in a way that makes everybody happy, and I mean everybody. The table was quiet, waiting. You know, sometimes it helps to get nonverbal for a minute. Carlos, can you share your logo ideas? Martin said, turning to the designer. Anand and Jones almost jumped out of their chairs. Anand took the lead. What do you mean, logo? Have you already stolen this and turned it into a product? Martin was quick to explain. Linda said it would help her with the writing segment, defining, brainstorming, etc. These are just what I said, a nonverbal addition to the discussion. Absolutely nothing is set, okay? Jones looked at the graphic designer, who was a perfect knockoff of a character in his TV episode on corporate greed, entitled How Low Can You Go? So, what's the corporate image, Carlos? Jones asked. Oh no, sorry man, I was just trying to help the conversation. I went non-corporate. This idea I had was like a combo of working together and justice. Any objections to just taking a look? Martin asked. Well, it seems like putting the cart before the ox, but go ahead, Krishna conceded. The sketches Carlos presented managed to couch the radical notion in a corporate respectability. Two logos were graphics only, but the third included a word. Veritage? Jones asked. The writer quickly turned to him and explained. She was a big fan of Jones and was thrilled and a little nervous to come to his aid. Ryoko used the term in her report, and it struck me as a possible name for the whole concept, one that played up the whole truth-telling component. It would be helpful to have a catchy name that's more interesting than what closed captioning was. You know, not like, TV commenting. Martin added, at the risk of putting the cart before the ox, as Krishna said, I think this potential name shows that we can establish from the beginning that the program is something having to do with integrity, which I hope would satisfy all of you and also be something the networks could sell, since, to be frank, selling broadcast content plus advertising is their business. So let's get the cart back where it belongs. Ryoko, can you define veritage as you use the term? Ryoko hedged. Let me ask you to clarify. Sorry, I'm better at interviewing than answering. You want to create a program that is administered, not freeform, and call it veritage. This veritage would somehow stay independent and beyond censorship, which would give the networks a chance to sell themselves as having integrity. And you think that that will somehow be a lucrative formula? Exactly. The room was silent. Marion Fox, director of public relations, made her only comment of the meeting. You're going to have to balance the independent nature of the commenting with the network's fears of controversy and liability. But if you play the integrity piece authentically, it should keep the public on your side. Theoretically. At the end of the two-hour meeting, Director John Martin had glided the group into congenially devising a special ATB committee administering the Veritage program. Martin authorized creation of a new Veritage-based news network, funded by the majors, located in D.C., dubbed Integrity Network. It would serve as a fact-checking home base for major network programs and be headed by Editor-in-Chief Ryoko Kimura. Finally, he tapped Joseph Jones to serve as spokesperson for the entire program, helping the public through the implementation. Walking out of the building onto K Street, Krishna indulged his celebrity curiosity. Would you like to get a drink, Joseph? We have time, right, Ryoko? She nodded. Jones agreed. Sure, sounds good. Let's go to the Tombs in Georgetown. It'll be quiet. He flagged his driver, who was waiting in the no-standing lane for him. Then he turned to Ryoko and said, You're really going to move to D.C. for this? I'd never live anywhere in the States but New York. Washington, D.C., 2002. The Veritage program created a new category of celebrity, the celebrity commenter, nicknamed Comstar within Veritage circles. Comstars were unaffiliated viewers whose consistent wit or insight got them noticed by other viewers, and ultimately by program producers and Veritage workgroup staff. It wasn't hard to imagine that someone commenting with a national audience would come to the audience's attention, yet no one in the Veritage workgroup had envisioned the scenario. When the phenomenon began appearing, about 3 months after the program launched, Ryoko Kimura hosted a panel discussion on air to discuss the issue of commenters who wielded exceptional influence. After discussing the possible ways that a Veritage program with Comstars could play out, Ryoko implored industry people to refrain from attempting to influence Comstars or recruit them for endorsements or advertising. She encouraged viewers to treat Comstars like any other commenters, rather than treating their comments as more important than their own. Her final remark to the panel was, I implore you to share in our mission to change the way things are done in the media, so that when history looks back, our use of the name integrity will not be considered cynically as branding, but as a call for excellence that all broadcasters strive for. The result of the panel discussion on the Integrity Network was startling. While viewers took Ryoko's advice and did not passively hand over the commenting reins to Comstars, show producers reacted in a way that the most optimistic in the Veritage workgroup did not dare to hope for. Rather than trying to buy or otherwise sway Comstars with the purpose of endorsing their programming, they listened to Comstars' criticism as special focus group data and began to revamp and improve the quality of programs in response. Contemporary media studies scholars began to distinguish pre- and post-Veritage TV as different media eras, and a Harvard professor made headlines when, on a talk show, he called Veritage-driven programming a new incarnation of television. Chapter 4, Lucy. Brooklyn, 1939. Lucy's grandfather, Vladimir Lubchik, was a Ukrainian who had fled from ever-decaying conditions in Stalin's USSR to nearly as bad conditions in Mussolini's Italy. The year he spent in a small port town on the Adriatic provided him two valuable assets, a passable knowledge of Italian, and connections with people who had connections in America. He made his way to Carroll Gardens, Brooklyn, in 1939, with two buddies who worked the docks with him. They were slipping out just before the realities of war began spreading beyond Italy's urban areas. Vlad's Italian, albeit with an accent, and his paisan traveling buddies granted him welcome in the tightly knit Italian immigrant longshoreman community that served Brooklyn's bustling docks. He met his boss-to-be over grappa at Francesco Trattoria the weekend he arrived in town, and impressed him by drinking half the regulars under the table. That Monday, Vlad was unloading raw materials from an African freighter for nearby parts manufacturers. A year later, Vlad and his working buddies applied for citizenship and got it, and the year after that, he was applying for a bank loan to buy a brownstone on Union Street. He got the bank's letter of approval on the same day that he got his draft notice. The general consensus among the longshoremen was that they should all go kick Mussolini's fascist culo. Vlad's working knowledge of Italian and Russian got him bumped up from the infantry to the Signal Intelligence Division, where he learned quite a bit about radio and continued to hone his language skills. When he returned to Brooklyn after the war, the city had changed. Some of his former friends had died in combat. Some younger longshoremen had relocated after being discharged, sometimes to the hometowns of their new wives, whom they had met at USO events or on bases in Europe. His former boss had retired. Vlad wasn't looking forward to returning to the backbreaking labor on the docks. He had grown accustomed to using mental skills in the army. He went to see a movie one afternoon to get a break from the summer heat. A newsreel about the rebuilding in Europe screened before the show, and in one of the shots, the camera caught another crew filming. Vlad saw the sound man standing next to the cameraman, and a light bulb clicked on in his head. New York was the center of the new television broadcasting boom, and Vlad's quick thinking got him in on the ground floor. His natural ability for hearing and tweaking sound made him the go-to sound man, and he quickly picked up skills that helped him transition from a technician to a producer. He often ate and spent his evenings after work at the busy bar of a restaurant on 40th Street. About a year into his job, he had a lunch meeting there to plan an experimental three-camera setup when Anita Garcia walked in. She had voluptuous rust-colored hair and light brown skin, and she curved in all the places that appealed to his Ukrainian sensibilities. She smiled at him in passing on her way from the front door. He turned to watch her and saw that she headed into the kitchen. When she emerged several minutes later, wearing a waitress apron, he was pleased to know he could find her again so easily. He asked her out one night when he had been at the bar for a few hours and had one too many Boilermakers. She instructed him to ask her when he was sober, in case he thought better of it. He was embarrassed for a week, and then got up the nerve to ask her again shortly after he came in, before she went back into the kitchen. He was nervous and spoke like a knight in a movie. She told him to ask her again when he was less uptight, a word he didn't understand, but got translated by one of the other patrons who frequented the jazz clubs up on 42nd Street. Vlad had little experience with women outside of hormone-fueled encounters as a youth and then in Italy during the war. He wasn't sure what to make of the rejections. They were no's, but in both cases, she gave him hope that there was a chance. This level of complicated was something he had only seen in TV dramas he worked on, like courtroom shows where someone was hiding something. He wondered if she was hiding something. The third time he asked Anita out, he tried to use some of the phrases his jazz fan compatriot had taught him, hoping it would help him appear less uptight, though his nerves were making him perspire and he had downed a shot of vodka just before speaking to her. "Sorry to be so square the other times we spoke. It sure would be cool to go out with you." She told him to ask her again when he was back to being himself. He didn't see Anita for a week after that. Another waitress was in her place. He finally asked the bartender where she was. "She got fired for mouthing off to the boss," he said in a Polish accent. Then he scowled, "Intelligentsia." "What do you mean?" Vlad asked. "She's some kind of doctor of something, at that new college or new school, something like that." He went back to drying highball glasses. "Why is she working here then?" Vlad asked, shocked at the revelation. "Hell if I know. Maybe they don't pay her enough." Vlad casually asked if he knew where that college was. The bartender turned up his nose and pointed to the phone book. Vlad knew nothing of colleges or the people who inhabited them. He decided to have a look. He paid for his drink and stepped out into the golden evening light, where he walked to the F train station to catch the subway to Greenwich Village. When he arrived at the 12th Street address he had found in the phone book, he saw a building that stood out from its neighbors, a modernist block that reached five stories above the adjacent brownstones. On the sidewalk below the overhang of black and white striped brick, clusters of students leaned against the wall, intently discussing, pointing at a book here, flipping through a notebook there. He was surprised that something having to do with school could hold so much interest on a summer evening. He walked inside and through the curvy, narrow lobby into an egg-shaped auditorium with a ceiling of oval fins that looked like something he'd seen in a Hollywood movie. Students were in little groups within the raked seating. One group was having an animated discussion. Vlad noticed Anita's hair in that group. She was arguing with one of the boys. Vlad walked over to Anita. Naivete gave him the power to stroll into the discussion without a thought of what he would say when he got there. Anita saw him coming down the aisle and put up a finger to silence her opposition. She turned to Vlad. The students sitting and standing around Anita looked him over. "Are you yourself today or a hipster?" "Oh, I'm me, all right." "Good. You can resolve this debate." One of the boys puffed up. "Wait, who is this? Does he teach here?" "No, gentlemen and ladies. This is Vlad. He's from the real world. Vlad, could you tell these sheltered youths what the most important thing in the world is?" The puffed up boy started to object, but Anita silenced him with a grunt. "Well, there's a lot of things that's important in the world, I guess," he hedged, hoping he wasn't going to blow this attempt at a date as well. "Of course, Vlad," Anita led. "But when it comes right down to living, what's the most important thing?" She turned to watch the boys hear the response. "Well, you gotta have a good job so you can make enough money." He looked at her and was relieved to see her smiling at the puffed up boy. "What jobs have you had, Vlad?" she continued without taking her eyes from her browbeaten student. "Well, I worked in a store as a kid. Then when I got older, I started working with boats. I had to get out of Kiev before the war. That's in Ukraine. So I went to Italy and worked on the docks. Then some of us guys come over to Brooklyn, and we was longshoremen there." "But you don't do that now, right?" "No, I work in TV now. I'm a producer. We started broadcasting a spelling bee contest the other week," he threw in with hopes that it would show him as something of an educated person. "How did you get to be in TV?" Anita asked, skipping the spelling bee altogether. "I learned a lot about radio in the army. I got trained on account of knowing Italian and Russian, and English too, of course." Anita looked like a trial lawyer who had just produced the deciding piece of evidence. "So you see, my young friends, improvement of the workers' conditions depends on availability of education and training and freedom to shift careers to take advantage of opportunity." "Professor," one of the girls timidly asked, "won't women's roles as mothers make that shifting impossible, even if the opportunity is there?" "The principles are the same regardless of sex. It's not okay for fathers or mothers to have to leave their families for a job." "I read that happens," the girl added, holding timidly to her point. "But it's hardly a desirable way to distribute resources. Structures need to be in place to let people, including their families, move freely when they find an opportunity." Vlad was drowning in the flood of verbal analysis, but two words had stood out: sex and opportunity. He spoke. "That's interesting. And speaking of opportunity, I wonder if I could take this opportunity to ask you to dinner." The students chuckled and waited for the rebuff, some expecting coolness, others heat. She surprised them all by writing her phone number on a business card and handing it to them. "I'm free this weekend," she said and smiled. "Why were you so tough on me?" Vlad asked Anita over dinner at the restaurant where they had met, at her request. "I don't just go out with any guy who comes into a bar," she said matter-of-factly. "I wanted to know who you were. It's kind of hard when you're at work anyway. Going out with the customers can give you a reputation, if you know what I mean." "I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to give you a reputation. I just like your smile, and I wanted to see more of what made it." "Why, Vlad, that's like poetry. Thank you." Vlad was quiet for a minute, then asked, "Why did you want to eat here?" She told them she took the job to serve as a case study in her research on treatment of low-wage workers. She was now ignoring the manager and bartender who kept staring at her. "I also like the cook. His filet of sole is superb." Later, they had cognac and Anita's invitation at her apartment on Christopher Street. She read him a poem in her language. He understood most of the words because they were similar to Italian. She was impressed with that and looked at him from the corner of her eye as a slight smile crept to her lips. "Just what are you getting me into, Vladimir Lubchik's salt of the earth?" There was no lilt and almost no question in her question. He put down his empty snifter and took her in his arms. He had not been with a woman since a weekend leave in Rome 3 years earlier. Their lovemaking was simple and deep, like a meditation without thoughts. Vlad and Anita conceived a daughter that night. She mentioned it to him matter-of-factly on one of a string of enjoyable dates 6 weeks later. He was stunned and surprised her by being quite happy with the news. She knew of doctors who could end the pregnancy and was deciding what to do independent of Vlad. The last thing she expected was what she heard.
"You must marry me."
"Must?
Sorry, I'm so surprised. I'm thinking in Ukrainian. I mean, dear Anya, Anitechka, will you please marry me and be my wife?"
"Marry you?"
"Yes, please. We will already be having a little one. What a blessing."
"Vlad, I don't know what to say. I'm not wife material. I'm a professor, a thinker, a feminist, for God's sake. You are the mother of my child, and the smile that makes my heart swell. I do not ask you to be a wife except as you are." She stared down into her pasta at the restaurant she had been fired from 2 months earlier. He reached his upturned hands across the table where they implored hers.
"Te amo," he said.
She looked up. "Tu hablas español ahora." "For you," he smiled. "I will do anything for you." Vlad and Anita raised their daughter Maria as upper-middle-class New Yorkers until she was 6 years old. She was a brilliant and precocious child, the image of her mother with the charm of her father. They were a modern family in the hub of a modern world. Both Maria's parents were called before the House Un-American Activities Committee during a sweep of the entertainment industry. The committee chairman declared them communists because the husband was from what was now the Soviet Union, and the wife's lectures were filled with socialist ideas that connected her to Cuban revolutionary in exile Fidel Castro. The case against them, in times other than the McCarthy era, would have been dismissed as even less than circumstantial. These were not other times, however, and both parents were to be deported. Vlad tried to convince Anita that their better choice was to ask for asylum in Europe, but she insisted that they go to Cuba. Vlad spent the rest of his life producing television for Cuba's government-controlled television station, first helping show the evils of communism under Batista, then the evils of capitalism under Castro. But while his work was content neutral, Anita's lectures at the university in Havana were an unbridled mix of praise and criticism for aspects of both the former and latter government's activities. She was ostracized by key members of the university administration, who were government loyalists. Her willingness to write for dissident journals got her hassled by state censors and got Vlad in hot water at his network. He managed to pacify his superiors by saying he would try to modulate Anita's more inflammatory political activities. The strafing of their apartment building was the last straw in a father's decision-making process. It happened one weekend in 1970 when the family was out to dinner. They returned to find their apartment building emblazoned with black spray-painted words, "Get U.S. values out of Cuba," with a dollar sign as the S, and a line of bullet holes as an underline. Vlad told Anita she would have to toe the party line for the sake of their daughter. His wife of 15 years turned to him. She spoke to him in English, which they did not speak except in their most intimate moments. "You have held to your promise so well, Vlad. You've let me be a wife as the woman I was when you met me. I suppose I should be grateful. I didn't expect it to last this long before I would be expected to live another way." Vlad stuttered in response to her statement. "Anita, of course I want you to be yourself, but this is for our daughter. I'm not asking you not to be you." He was silent, looking at her. She was staring out the window of their apartment.
He noticed small wrinkles from the corners of her eyes and lines across her forehead. She smiled, and the lines and wrinkles deepened. Then she began to cry. "You have been fighting for your ideas for so long, darling. Forgive me for asking you to change. I promise you, I only want you as you are." "But you're right, Vlad. How does one live on ideals when life is not ideal? It was not ideal with McCarthy. It was not ideal under Batista. It's not ideal under Castro. Perhaps now it's best back in the U.S. "Well, but that's not an option for us, thanks to the FBI, and now Castro." He was silent. She sniffled and looked for a handkerchief in her sweater pocket. "Perhaps," he began, after a minute of wringing his hands, "now it's best back in the U.S. for Maria. Perhaps she has another life available there."
"For Maria? How would,
you mean alone?" "Does your cousin Juan still live in Brooklyn? His boy Ricardo was Maria's age, right?" "He sends a card at Christmas still from Brooklyn, and you and Juan are close family, right?" "Yes, but I don't know, even if I could give up Maria, if Juan would be able to take her in." Vlad moved to sit next to her on the sofa and reached into his pants pocket. He pulled out and placed several empty bullet shells on the coffee table. "From the street in front of our apartment, darling, I'll do anything for you. But can we please send our daughter to safety as a compromise? That way, you maintain your ideals here, but I can do my duty as a father." Anita nodded, then leaned her head on Vlad's chest and cried. One of Anita's colleagues knew a boat captain who agreed to smuggle Maria the 90 miles to Key West, and from there the teen took a bus to New York. Maria went to live with Anita's cousin, Juan, his wife, Inez, and his son Ricardo in an apartment above the Brooklyn shoe repair shop where Juan worked. Maria's cousin Ricardo spent every waking minute that he wasn't figuring out schoolwork or shining shoes ogling Maria. He kept stealing glances when she sat in view at the table in the backyard behind the shop. He fantasized about her when she was off with friends. He made love to her image in bed at night. Maria was both homesick for her parents and glad to be in the U.S. where ordinary life seemed easier than it had been in Havana. She went to the same high school as Ricardo, but she received her real education via correspondence course from her mother. Anita sent lists of books she was to read and films to see. She read Maria's reports and essays via the mail and sent back extensive comments. While Maria feigned annoyance, she thrived on the intellectual stimulation. As she grew older, the freedom the arrangement provided suited her more and more. She lost interest in what seemed to her immature schoolmates and became a curious, studious loner. Maria easily found the books her mother required her to read. The articles were trickier to discover, but a helpful librarian became her ally on the challenging pursuits. The films were impossible, though. She could see the current film screenings listed in the newspaper, but had no idea where to look for the documentaries and classics her mother told her to see. An article in a current issue of Art in America by Janet Jones reviewed one of the films her mother asked her to find. The librarian came across the article during one of her monthly searches for Maria. Maria thanked the librarian, but then expressed her frustration with not finding any of the actual films showing. The librarian suggested that Maria contact the author of the article through the journal's editor, an idea that was met with a kiss on the cheek from an exuberant teenager, with new hope for solving one of her young life's biggest problems. 2 weeks later, Maria was sitting with Janet Jones in a small cafe on Amsterdam Avenue near Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts. Janet was dressed in a paisley print dress and go-go boots. An Eve Klein blue headband bridged the waterfall of platinum hair that spilled to her shoulder blades. "Do you want a cigarette?" Janet offered, without waiting for an answer. Maria took the cigarette, but never lit it, while Janet spoke nonstop, except to drag on her own cigarette, of each film in Maria's letter, which lay in front of her. "Let me see what's playing. I note everything interesting in my diary." Janet produced a palm-sized leatherette-bound appointment book. She flipped through the upcoming 2 weeks and flagged three of the films on Maria's letter and jotted down the film house, university, and museum where they were to be shown. Juan and his wife were in completely over their heads with Maria. It was as if a princess had come to live with some subjects. About all Inez could teach the precocious ward were some tips for dealing with her voluminous rust-colored hair. She showed her how to make it spiral into a beautiful ponytail.
They ultimately relied on the instructions in Anita's monthly letters from Cuba. Ricardo began complaining that Maria got to do so many things on her own, and his attraction to her transformed into sibling rivalry. He got interested in a girl at school and began to explore the lessons of love behind the school building with her. Maria was, in fact, getting to do many things on her own, and with Inez and Juan unaware and without much authority, she became part of Janet Jones' art crowd. While young Ricardo and their classmates held no interest for Maria, the 20-something men in Janet's crowd evoked mystery and allure. Maria had a curfew because traveling in subways past 11 was dangerous, but she was otherwise free to go to screenings, openings, happenings, and parties, all under the guise of studying what Anita assigned. She became an attractive regular at art events. Janet kept Maria under her wing initially, but as the alcohol and drugs circulated through an evening, she would get distracted and start introducing her willy-nilly to the nearby artists, directors, writers, and those who liked to party with them. One of the writers was Janet's husband, Joseph Archibald Jones, a poet Maria's mother had her read. He told her to call him Archie, and they spoke often when Janet had drifted away. He stayed long enough to make her feel taken care of, but not chaperoned. They often ended up in long conversations on a range of topics, including her mother's assignments. Maria had read but didn't understand his poetry, but she wouldn't dare let on, and instead asked him one night, "How would you describe your poems?" He stared into space for a moment, then looked into her eyes and replied, "I write about the nexus of art and love." With little experience in either, that didn't help her understand his poems any better, but she told him she liked them. The tall, slightly hunched poet shook his shoulder-length hair like a lazy lion in response. He was ruggedly handsome and seemed gentle, and Maria talked to him like a best friend. When she told him about her mother's assignments, he tried to think of further sources for seeing the films. After several months of hanging out, Archie spotted Maria at an art opening. "Hey, Maria, what's shaking?" he asked with a side-to-side flick of his mane. "You are Shaggy," she kidded him and then gave him a hug. As he pulled slowly away, he whispered, "I might have a solution to your film conundrum." He surveyed the room, then waved over and introduced her to Rusty Scott, a young director he knew. "Hey, baby doll, what's happening?" Rusty asked with a big grin. Maria looked over the rose-bespectacled, leather-clad cineast. "Wow, you look like Peter Fonda." Rusty put his arm lightly around Maria's waist. Archie reached out towards Rusty's shoulders to spin him around for a quiet warning about her age. Before he said anything, Janet screamed from the other side of the room. Archie looked and saw her looking toward him, Rusty, and Maria, and noticed the smashed wine glass at her feet. Janet started crying. Archie went to her aid and waved to Rusty to follow. Before going, Rusty told Maria he had lots of films in his apartment and had a friend at the NYU film library where he could get anything else. He kissed her lightly and handed her a business card. Maria called him up the next day, and her cheek buzzed with the memory of his kiss when he answered. She asked if he had the film she was after, and he cooed into the phone that he could get whatever she wanted. She had struck the mother lode and made a date for some private screenings. When Maria had a baby at the age of 18, never having revealed the identity of the father to Juan and Inez, she flabbergasted them by announcing she was considering naming the little girl Ilsa Rosebud, because she sprang from either Casablanca or Citizen Kane. The poor foster parents begged the girl to honor the request Anita had made in her latest letters to name the child after Vlad's parents, Vladimir, if a boy, and Ludmila, if a girl. Ricardo laughed at Maria's idea and said a kid named Rosebud would get the you-know-what beat out of her on the playground. One of the last things Janet Jones had said to her before Maria found out she was pregnant and discreetly dropped out of Janet's scene was, "Just look at Lucy go. That woman's got all the men under her finger." She was speaking of Lucille Ball and Desilu, the first woman-run television studio. Ricardo's cracks about the other kids gave Maria the idea to name her independently created daughter after an independent modern woman, and who better than one on TV in honor of her father's business, if not his parents. Thus Maria and her mystery mate begat Lucy Lubchick.
Brooklyn, 1996. After he dropped out of high school, Billy Wilson had two passionate pursuits. If you asked him if he worked, he would have told you he never worked a day in his life. So much were his vocational activities like avocations. He was a mechanic at a garage belonging to a friend of his late father. He was so good at fixing things that his skills appeared miraculous, and the customers at Old Man Pablo's shop started to treat him as a kind of god of the mechanical world. When Billy wasn't at Pablo's garage, he was brewing artisanal coffee at Fort Green Bean, where he had applied his mechanical aptitude to coffee-making technologies to create perfect espresso drinks, brewed coffees, and teas. He had tweaked the La Marzocco after the company technician had left it with an annoying vibration when you valved down the steam. He incorporated a thermos for the French press that kept the second cup hot without bitterness. He redirected a section of the ventilation system to create a tea oasis free of the stronger coffee aromas. A year after Billy's dad had died, Billy's mother emerged from the bubble that had muffled her world since receiving the call starting, "Mrs. Wilson, this is Officer Chavez. I'm afraid I have some bad news for you." She got out of bed around 9:30 like every other morning, peed, splashed her face, wrapped her straightened hair in a bandana, and went to make coffee. She noticed her son sitting on the overstuffed sofa gazing at the TV from under a baseball cap with a Pennzoil logo. She couldn't remember him being anywhere else in recent history. "Shouldn't you be in school?" she asked, the words struggling to fall from her mouth. "I quit school last year. Are you high or something?" "So wait, you just hang out here all the time?" He sat up, his muscular 6-foot frame exuding an easy strength. "Mom, I know you were just asleep, but sheesh, you're scaring me. You know I go down to the shop and help Pablo work on cars. I work at the Bean. I go to the gym. I watch TV with you, etc." "Right, right. I don't know what's wrong with me. I feel like my mind was on vacation and it just got back. But Billy, you're only 19 years old. You have to go to school." "I don't like school, Mom. It's irrelevant. What's wrong with what I'm doing?" "Well, does Pablo pay you?" "No. Do we need money?" "No, that's not the point. It's good to have a real job, not a barista job, so you can earn a living. That's what adults do. Why doesn't Pablo pay you?" "He's barely making it. He's a nice guy, but honestly, I think without me there, his place would go down the tubes. I handle the hard jobs. I haven't started talking to vendors and stuff." "Do you like that work?" He flipped his hat so the brim went to the back. "Yeah, it's cool. Fixing broken stuff feels good." "Maybe you should have your own place." "Mom, that's so weird. Pablo just said that yesterday." "Maybe Pablo wants you out. Maybe you make him look bad or something." I think he's kind of tired. He's like 70 years old." "Really? Huh. What's his phone number? Why?" "Maybe he doesn't want you out. Maybe he's looking to get out. He might be trying to plant an idea, and it just sprouted in my head." "What idea?" he asked, shrinking in posture when he realized he missed something. "You're running his shop. How about buying his shop?" With Pablo's enthusiastic agreement, Billy's mother seized the opportunity to make the garage where Billy played auto mechanic into his own shop. To accommodate the workload over the next few years, Billy quit his barista job, and Billy's mother resolved her own malaise by taking on the office side of the business. Brooklyn, 1998. Joseph Jones walked down the street in his first month of the 21st year of his life. So far, he had experienced the ups and downs typical of a New York youth. His parents had separated when he was 5, mom off to France with her beau, Joseph growing up in New York. But he had just moved out of his dad's after graduating from college, which felt fantastic. Just last night, he was out late at a party with no worries about coming home and waking his dad. He was on his way from his new internship at the Brooklyn Museum. Life was good. Joseph walked past the school on the corner of Flatbush Avenue where Billy Wilson had grown from a boy to an adolescent, MS-321, a.k.a. Jonas Bonard Middle School. Joan Ass Bone Ass, as Billy's classmates called it through their giggles and guffaws.
In high school, Billy became the kid in class who was least likely to succeed, according to the laws of high school, that is. He got bad grades, showed up drunk once or twice, and had no friends in the school. Joseph did not know Billy, nor that Billy was on his way to owning several car repair shops across the tri-state area. He might be shocked to hear that at the same age as Joseph, Billy owned a house and drove an antique Porsche. But Joseph would never meet Billy at any time in this life, so there was nothing gained on that front. Joseph heard his phone ring just as he stepped off the curb onto 6th Avenue. He'd been waiting for a return call from Lucy Lubchick, that hot chick he met at the party last night. So he looked down at the caller ID readout on his phone, and his lips curled into a smile that could make him a teen icon. He paused a step and pressed answer. As he was lifting the phone toward his ear, an old blue Chevy with a black front fender swerved hard from Flatbush onto 6th Avenue to the sound of honking from the cars it had cut off. Joseph was the only obstacle remaining in the way of the Chevy, and he was sent across the car's hood. His phone skidded down Flatbush.
"Hello,"
repeated several times to the asphalt before a kid in a hoodie picked it up. He saw the name Lucy disappear from the screen. The kid pushed the hood off his head and walked over to where the crowd was gathering around Joseph, face up on the ground. A policewoman was about to push him away as she made her way toward the body. "I think this is his phone," the kid said. "Were you a witness to the accident?" the cop asked, shifting focus. "No, I was just going that way and saw the phone slide by me." "Okay, thank you," she said, refocusing on her progress toward the body, phone now in hand. Joseph, without breath or heartbeat, stared at the sky through unblinking lids, the blue canopy becoming speckled with stars growing ever brighter until they merged into a solid white ether. Lucy in the sky with diamonds hummed from the hanging earbuds of a witness's CD player. Brooklyn, 2002. "You're late again," Billy's mom chided him. "Everybody's standing around waiting for you." "They keep asking me to tweak the machine after Big Lou whacks it out of balance again. Plus now they're trying to expand the tea area." He looked for some better excuse. "I'd be on time if you would get my coffee." "I've got enough to do before you get here. I'm not going to drop everything to get you coffee. You'll just have to make coffee here. Or have tea." "Tea's okay for the afternoon, Mom. I need my morning coffee." He spun his hat around and looked through the waiting room plexiglass. The rectangular stainless steel drip device in his garage's large waiting room brewed coffee that was suited to a diner at best, and Billy simply couldn't put the bitter brown liquid in his mouth. That afternoon, the La Marzocco tech brought his Alfa Romeo to Billy for a tune-up. They'd been talking shop for a bit when the tech mentioned that one of his customers was enlarging his facilities and getting rid of a roaster and an espresso machine. Billy's mouth began to water. He looked past the lift bay toward the large waiting room, and everything became clear. Billy's mom loved his idea to create a cafe adjoining the shop and jumped right in to take care of the administrative requirements. Billy had the roaster shipped and installed it in an insulated metal shed behind the building where a 1968 VW had been rusting away. The La Marzocco tech installed the espresso machine, and Billy made some custom adjustments. All that was left was to find a barista. He taped up ads on poles on his way home. Lucy Lubchick walked out of BAM Cinematheque reeling from David Lynch's Blue Velvet. She wanted to go get a beer at the bar on the corner, but realized she had blown her last few dollars on the movie. She regretted having spent money on a ticket. She had seen Lynch's film twice before. Both times it took her about a year to forget how disturbing it was. All she remembered was that she loved Isabella Rossellini, in part because Lucy's mother had confessed that Rossellini's mother had played a supporting role in Lucy's conception. A gypsy cab looking for a fare beeped at Lucy and startled her. She dropped her wallet. She kicked the lamppost out of frustration and bent to pick up her spill of identification cards. She picked up her expired college ID and yelled at the logo, "When are you going to get me a job? It's been a year already." When she stood up, she noticed the ad for a barista on a pole and pulled off one of the phone number tabs. "How hard can being a barista be? I can make coffee," she said and put the number in her wallet. A month later, Billy's mom called him into the office. "Billy," his mom said, and pointed at the chair across from her, "shut the door." Billy slid into the chair, facing his mother across the desk. He took off his hat and spun it on his outstretched fingers. "What's up, Mom?" "That new girl can't make coffee. You want me to hire someone else?" "Definitely not," he blurted, then hemmed his words. "I'll give her some tips." He stood up quickly and flipped the hat onto his head with the brim to the back. Lucy added a third avocation to Billy's life. Despite her inadequacies as a barista, she was so entertaining that the cafe quickly became full of repeat customers. Billy worked out a few foolproof systems to help Lucy, including an ingenious espresso tamper made from a hydraulic roadside repair jack. Billy's mother was thrilled to see her son interested in a girl and figured out how to pay a second barista. Freed from behind the counter, Lucy served as mistress of ceremonies among the artists, performers, full-time moms, and growing stream of car repair customers. Billy was approached by a venture capitalist who walked his dog past the shop every day and saw the growing customer base. When the salt and pepper-haired man began his corkscrew financing pitch, Billy thought he was speaking a language other than English and asked the guy to talk to his mother. Billy's mom brought in their attorney and accountant for a meeting a week later, and by the end of his 19th year, Billy was the 60% owner of three auto repair shops in the tri-state area, each with an adjoining cafe. Lucy Lubchek circulated among the shops, helping each one build clientele through a combination of advice and her regular appearances, which would always result in one or two new loyal customers, entranced by her radiant playfulness. Billy provided continual training for the senior mechanics, who spent a day each month working alongside him. While these more seasoned mechanics humored their boss at first, all of them soon found that these monthly sessions left them with a new trick or a more thorough understanding of a system, and they came to respect Billy's talent and lack of pretense. Lucy loved her job. The interaction with all the creative people and the informal working conditions were a dream she occasionally feared she would wake from. She resisted her new boss, who was clearly interested in her beyond her challenged barista skills. As she continued to work, he respected her boundaries, and in the space that provided, she grew to admire his manner and the mastery that he brought to everything he did. On Valentine's Day, toward the end of her 6 month, he gave her a little box of candy hearts and a small package. She tore the meticulously folded and ribboned paper to reveal a boxed set of films by Krzysztof Kieslowski that she had been talking about with him one day at closing time. She exuberantly hugged him, nearly shouting what a great gift it was. He told her he had watched Red and White and cried at both. He asked her to tell him what she thought they meant sometime. He watched her and felt what he had resting in each of his closed hands. Lucy's breath skipped. She said, "I'd love to tell you, my take at least." On hearing her acceptance, Billy raised his right hand and held a candy heart in front of her. She looked, "Be mine." She ate the candy and smiled. He popped a white heart from his left hand into his mouth, where "Go fish" dissolved on his tongue. When Lucy and Billy watched Kieslowski's Colors and then his Decalogue over the course of the next month, they played off the films to learn about each other's history, points of view, and feelings. They also came to an understanding of their differences, which were primarily a matter of orientation to life. He was a doer, and she was a thinker. Interestingly, his doing was a little introverted, and her thinking was a fair amount extroverted. So they dovetailed nicely, which had already demonstrated its effectiveness on the job. "Why don't you write about movies for other people?" Billy asked her, "like they do in the paper." "You mean a critic?" "Yeah, I guess, like that guy and girl on TV who talk about the movies. They're terrible. You'd be much better at it." "I wanted to do that in college, but I couldn't get on the paper then, and I don't know how you even get started. Anyway, I love what I'm doing now." "Well, I'm glad, but it seems like you have so much to offer with so many good ideas about what everything means." "Critical theory major, an opinion about everything." "Maybe you could write stuff in those comments that they have on TV now," Billy suggested. "Veritage? I always think old maids and teenagers are the only ones who do that. But yeah, I guess I could at least practice, quote, honing my critical voice, unquote, on Veritage. At least I know it will get published. Thanks for the idea, Billy." A year later, Lucy was on her computer in the office of Pablo's garage when Billy came in and put a freshly degreased hand on her shoulder. She smiled and put her hand atop his, then continued typing and hit send.
You will not believe who I just got an email from, she said, shutting the lid of her laptop.
I give up. Who?
Krishna Anand. Can you believe it?
Who's that, a yoga guy?
Billy, Krishna Anand, Veritas, Ryoko Kimura. Oh, the guy who invented it. Right. Why did he write you?
He wants to talk to me about commenting, like system improvement stuff. Well, that makes sense. You're so popular as a commenter.
I have to go to DC, but they're paying for the train, she said, already en route in her mind. Wow, I wonder if I'll get to meet Jocko Jones. Wouldn't that be amazing?
It would, but, you know, he's probably not really involved. He just made some ads for it, probably. Yeah, I guess you're right. I wonder if Krishna Anand is talking to other comm stars. Nah, he's got the comm superstar. Why would he need anybody else? She kissed Billy right at the level in front of her face. He reflexively jumped at it, the peck to his solar plexus, then bent forward and kissed her properly on the lips. Lucy was sitting in the lobby of the Integrity Network when Ryoko Kimura walked through. Lucy jumped up, and a security guard at the front door stood a few inches taller in response. Lucy called out Ryoko's name. Lucy's smile and Ryoko's smile in return put the security guard at ease. How do you do? Ryoko asked, extending her hand.
Hello, I'm a big fan. Sorry, I'm Lucy Lupchik.
Nice to meet you, Ms. Lupchik, and thank you.
Wait, you're Lucy Lupchik.
Yes, I still pronounce it like my mom did in Ukrainian. Of course, you know my comm ID, almost the same. I picked it to make my mechanic boyfriend laugh.
Well, doubly nice to meet you. Thank you for the outstanding comments and critiques. You're meeting with Krishna this morning, right?
Yeah, something about system enhancements.
Yes, I might stop by your meeting at some point. Have you been to DC before?
I've never been anywhere, she replied. Well, except the tri-state area. You should go to the museums. They're great, and they're free. Sorry, but I have to run. It's truly an honor to meet you. Lucy sat back down, stunned at being complimented by one of the most important women in broadcasting. She pulled out her phone, went online to her favorite share site, and typed, "My self-esteem just shot into a new orbit."
Krishna Anand and Lucy Lupchik discussed Krishna's new idea of creating commenter pages on the Veritas website. He wanted her opinion on the pros and cons she saw. On the plus side, it would be easy to use commenters one liked as guides to programs and to get opinions of commenters one trusted about a wide range of topics all in one place. On the negative side, it could increase the likelihood of some commenters achieving celebrity status when the system's aims were more democratic.
They'd spoken for an hour when Ryoko joined their meeting. Lucy recapitulated the key points from her discussion with Krishna. They spoke for a few minutes longer, then Lucy excused herself in order to get back to Brooklyn in time to go to work.
You work at a garage? Ryoko asked, still curious that one of the nation's top critical voices had such an ordinary day job.
It's a garage, but there's a coffee shop attached as part of the business, and we have some cool stuff going on, like readings and music nights.
I think I read about that place when I was looking for a place to get my car worked on, Krishna said.
Paco's?
Pablo's, Lucy corrected.
Supposedly the best repair shop in New York, according to reviews, Krishna continued.
Best in the tri-state area. We have three shops in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut.
And they all have the coffee shop part two, Ryoko asked.
Yeah, running those is really my job.
Sounds great. Say, we could use a road trip, right, Ryoko? I have to bring my car into next time it needs a tune-up, Krishna smiled as he took her hand.
What do you have? Something good, I hope, Lucy smiled and peeked at Ryoko, excited that there might be another potential bond between them, that both their men cared about cars.
Don't look at her, Krishna said, nodding Ryoko's way. She only drives Toyotas.
I like Toyotas, some of them at least, Lucy retorted, smiling at Ryoko.
Well, I have an old Jaguar, which is why I always need a mechanic.
Ooh, nice. They need babying, though. Bring it by. Billy's the best.
What about Pablo? Ryoko asked, expecting the shop owner to be the master.
Pablo sold the place to Billy once every customer wanted Billy working on his car.
Well, I mean, he wanted to retire, too. It was amicable.
I'll bring it to Billy, and I'll let you know about the website developments. Thank you again, Lucy.
Krishna bobbled his head, then gave a swift nod and a handshake to say goodbye.
Seems like you made a good impression on Krishna Anand, Billy said, a week after the meeting Lucy had at the Integrity Network offices.
Why do you say that? She asked. I already told you it was a good meeting.
Billy spun his Penzoil hat around to put the brim to the back and kissed her. He made an appointment for me to look over his Jaguar XKE. And get this, he's driving it up from Washington. Cool, I told him you were the best. He hugged her hard and lifted her a foot off the ground. He wanted to know if you would be here to give him a tour.
Why, Billy Wilson, I do believe you're jealous.
Should I be? Aw, you're so cute. He's going out with Ryoko Kimura, so I wouldn't worry about it. Just let me know if he tries anything, and I'll put a slow leak in his brake lines.
You'd commit manslaughter for me? Billy, you are so romantic. How did I ever resist you?